This is Tall Tale TV, your podcast for sci-fi and fantasy short stories. Ghosts of the Mystic River, written by Dan A. Cardoza, performed by Chris Herron. Whoever said the undead have no sense of humor or capacity for good irony has been refuted by history, including the terminally rugged who reside at Stinking Point Cape. Stinking Point Cape cradles a slice of the Atlantic Ocean as it ebbs and flows its legacy of death and destruction. It's here the Atlantic Ocean insists on lapping its salty, dark tongue at the bone-dry beaches of the states Maryland and Virginia. Stinking Point was given its putrefying moniker because of all the bloody bodies that washed ashore during the Civil War. In our New Age underworld, we all share an uneasy community, a community given the name Metamorphosis. As uneasy inhabitants, we refer to it as Murgatory, a place neither heaven nor hell. Down here, we dwell as ghostly hunter and prey. Of course, it's a very complicated world that we live in. Here, those of us that have been murdered live amongst unsuspecting perpetrators, as well as well-known cold-blooded killers. We victims are encouraged to bond with the controlling husbands that have lost all semblances of empathy. We are rewarded for breakbreading with distraught lovers, the ones whose heartache has caused them to poison their men, hanging out with the children and teens who have killed because of displaced anger, and fear is eerily common. In appearance, we exist as we did in our previous lives, and age nicely along an intended lifeline of sorts. You might say our world is a parallel universe, but in truth, it isn't. Our existence is due to a grandiose experiment, a powerful hypothesis centuries away from yielding any tangible results. Our ghostly undertow of consciousness is non-dominational, a purgatory watched over by dark angels of loving grace and a self-absorbed deity named Llewellyn. Consider us as undead hyaline entities that have been released onto some mammoth stage of a petri dish by a mad celestial scientist. Like most gods, ours has peccadilloes and asperities, hers simply grander. Once you've been removed from among the living, entrance into Murgatory requires that you are a victim of a murder, or the perpetrator of a murder. It's that simple. Death, by natural cause, has no place here. She is in charge of all things redemption. Victims can visit their first world, but only in the form of an apparition, mostly to escape the underworld's oppressive environment. The haunted are encouraged to effect change up there, if we can. Though there are limits, our capabilities are deep and broad. Seeking revenge is common, but frowned upon in our underworld of atonement. However, tales of payback are common themes of those that return for good, themes we hear about too often. Even when getting even is supported by lofty pitchfork piles of reasoning. She is nothing if not about making things better. Most of the time, our underbelly universe is chock-full of bat-crazy wonder. On rare occasion, the haunted return for good and lose all ghosting privileges. Most of the time, it's because they were vengeful, killed someone. The few that have done this swear it was worth it. Most were eventually sent off to the nothingness. So it begs the question, why aren't serial killers and repeat offenders allowed to remain on Earth? I give you Charlie Manson and Adolf Hitler. Remember how I explained that she doesn't command much control up there? It's no surprise there are times she has to barter. Debts paid, debts owed. Once she has officially assigned each and every murderer to their atonement regimen, the community of Murgatory becomes their official incarceration, absent the clumsy steel doors. Over time, if they demonstrate themselves to be the true monsters they really are, then she can choose to displace them to the level of nothingness. All of the killers that reside in Metamorphosis are destined to live a virtual Groundhog's Day in perpetuity. She uses the replays to create reform, or if too much resistance, insanity. She has determined that because they hate themselves so much, part of their treatment includes a healthy dose of keeping their own company. Ironically, in Murgatory, there is no murder. It's never authorized or allowed by the master, Llewellyn. Everywhere, and I mean everywhere, the walls are eyes. The exception is the prior earth above. Up there, Llewellyn commands only moderate authority and influence. What's cool in our community is that you never age. You stay as you were above. The whole concept is quite elementary in nature, don't you agree? Oh, by the way, it's my understanding that not one single murderer down here has completed atonement or have ever been forgiven by she. Rumor has it, she allowed someone to question her once. God, what's the point then? Not pausing, she replied, "It's none of your damn business." In the rear view, Corey can barely make out the high cheekbones, the elephant trunk neck, and thorny Java man brow. It's pouring liquid obsidian outside. Uncle Palmer appears in his blind spot on the passenger side, next to the glassy darkness. He's staring through the sheen to his right, casually biding his time. Corey is relieved once he realizes it's only his uncle's facial outline, sketched in electricity by the receding lightning strike. In the sizzle of a second bolt, there's a flint and fire back there. Palmer's window has short-circuited and emptied. It's been purified in sheets of aquamarine, as viscous as antifreeze. Corey, a junior at the University of Massachusetts, Lowell, counts the mile markers as if they're anorexic headstones. Based on his streaking calculus, his toughest subject, Corey has a daunting 79 miles to go. He goes by Corey now. His father had called him Cordite, then Cord, and finally Corey, which eventually stuck. The word Cordite refers to a smokeless explosive made from nitrocellulose, nitroglycerin, and petroleum jelly used in ammunition. The insides of Cordite were twisted at birth, not unlike an inverted cyclone. For the rest of his life, he'd be stormy weather. It wasn't easy living as an anatomical punching bag for his Uncle Palmer. The truth is, the deeper cuts were from all the psychological abuse. They're nearly impossible to scab over and scar. His Uncle Palmer, Stepkin, had been nothing but trouble, a failed abortion. Corey lost both parents to a tragic threesome with crystal meth. That's when it fell on Aunt Melissa to finish rearing him. He was only 13 when he moved into the two-story clapboard down on the waterfront. Having no children of their own, Uncle Palmer had assigned Corey a seat in the front row, up close and personal. So close, he'd sit inside his Uncle Palmer's glare and reach. Up front, Corey became a pawn in an elaborate dark sideshow. He was a captive audience for the sociopathic maestro. Somehow, over time, everything Palmer couldn't have was Corey's fault. No one questioned the circus barker at first, his authority, or how he ran his sideshows. In Palmer's big tent, Corey witnessed the most evil of acts and violence, debauchery, as well as pedestrian mayhem. To know Palmer was to wear damp scabs. he was a bipolar Tasmanian devil. While performing his high-wire balancing act, Uncle Palmer would teeter and totter while juggling his tortured highs and lows. Aunt Melissa had accepted Corey's offer to ensure their survival. He'd create a recipe or tincture using his high school elements and periodic table. His warlock brew called for sweet southern tea, drips of southern comfort, and ethylene glycol. According to the coroner of the city of Boston, based on his autopsy report, Palmer had died from complications of hepatitis C, ostensibly from his penchant for lowbrow jailhouse neck tattoos. And just like that, before Corey completed high school, Uncle Palmer had boarded up the doors of the new family horror show. He turned into a one-man magic act and disappearing in a puff of smoke. Aunt Melissa and Corey celebrated using some of his $3 million life insurance payout with a trip to New York City and Coney Island, the place where real conjuring and magic is made. Immediately after Corey determined the back seat of his Accord was empty, the imp in the folds of his brain forced him to bring on a sardonic smile. The wind. He could feel the wind again as it resisted the front of his car. Relieved, he fixed his gaze again on the glistening, sutured yellows in the middle of the pavement before him. The road was famished as it swallowed up the fuel-injected Honda. There were few cars that evening. Apparently, he can't see me. I'm sitting directly behind him, but he can feel me, so he turns up the heater. There's a damp, swampy chill inside now. I was Corey's friend. Corey can almost taste his aunt's hot-crossed buns, pasted with orange ghee and her fresh-from-the-oven goose-pimpled turkey breast. Aunt Melissa's Thanksgiving supper had become a culinary wonder over the years. Thanksgiving was the only time of year Corey was grateful. I'm never invited, but I always attend unannounced and imperceptible. It's an annual ritual for those two. It's their annual bonding, a way to reassure one another that if one of them ever gets caught, the other won't turn around and make a deal with the prosecutors. After all, they are family, all they will ever have in the world, if you exclude a shitload of money. Skittering over the slippery, stitched yellows once more, in a panic, Corey turns 13 again. He'd wanted whiskers and a Fu Manchu stash in the worst way. He couldn't wait until he'd crashed into manhood. That day, he'd shave his face raw and bloody from effort. He'd been told by one of his punk friends at school, "The more you do it, the more it grows." Droplets of fresh blood splattered the bathroom floor, the black and white bakery French tile. In a panic, Corey had attempted his own first aid by reaching for a fresh washcloth in the linen closet. Applying pressure would do the trick, he thought. In the process and haste, he slipped and fell. He'd become a macabre sleigh in the sticky resin. Next thing you know, Corey's momentum slid him like a toboggan clear out into the sunlit hallway, where he finally settled. He lay on his back, frozen on the new beige carpet. The gushing blood stained the rug and his meticulously ironed white Sunday shirt. Worse, he'd be terribly late. Before he'd thought about getting up, his mother had yanked him to his feet, lobster clawing his right elbow and upper arm. Next, she marched him out through the living room, shoving him through the doorway. As he attempted a balancing act down the length of the icy front door steps on the sidewalk, Corey had fallen into the soot-stained snow. After he'd gotten to his feet and regained his bearing, in frenzy, Corey jogged all the way to Sunday Mass. At church, Corey had knelt and cinched his knuckles in prayer, making a bloody fist under his hamburger-raw chin. In the midst of all the sinning and worship, and the not-so-muffled guffaws, Corey had opened the entrance door tent flaps to his own personal circus, welcoming any and all to join in the stick-poking fun. Then he prayed that each petitioner's head would explode in a bright red mist. He had prayed that Jesus had never escaped from his cave. A few of his prayers have been unanswered. It wasn't but a few short weeks after Mass that Corey's mother overdosed. 6 months later, he'd moved in with Palmer and Aunt Melissa. Invisible sumo wrestlers shoved Corey's Accord side to side as he attempted to gain control. The steering wheel developed a mind of its own, spontaneously jerking right and then left. In the swampy stench of darkness, Corey's mother viciously tugged and jerked at his right elbow again. In an instant, Corey had been taken back to the crazy childhood bathroom and the freakish accident. He recalled how his mother had wrenched him to his feet, up from the blood-stained hallway carpet. In the orange glow of the dashboard lights, he could see her face next to his, smell the fetid breath of a meth addict, the rotting teeth. Instead of eyes and nostrils, there were droplets and swirls of writhing maggots. Her mouth and voice had been stitched together with fully butchered floor twine, each yellow stitch an infection. And then, the deluge of another firebolt from above. As the charred lightning ebbed, Corey's mother vanished. He felt sad that he couldn't remember her real face, yet thrilled that she was gone for good. Once again, Corey was alone, with the exception of his painful elbow. He struggled to keep himself moving forward. There were only 37 miles to go. Corey clutched his chest. He couldn't believe how his heart was racing. Hell, he'd read The Best of King and Oyeyemi and didn't break a sweat. It reminded Corey he loved a good scare now and then. But tonight, his fear was palatable, mercurial, and deliciously contagious. As if an explosion was building inside his chest from all the pain and guilt, Corey attempted to distract himself by powering his seat forward. In his discomfort and misery, I thanked him under my breath for the extra legroom. In the betrayal that was Corey's life, he thought it ironic that there weren't more passengers on this bone-cold November evening. He maniacally cursed at no one. "If I'm going to party, bring on all the goddamn skeletons!" Patiently observing his struggles, and now with the twisting steering wheel and all the weather, I silently watched as all the dead things in his life demanded to enter. Corey couldn't stand the freezing cold and blazing heat that melted and burned in his head because of his anxiety. He powered the driver's window down. He began to feel a little crazy not being alone. He pounded the side view mirror with a fist for whatever image it held and shattered. After, he shook his bloody knuckles up at the sky. "Bring it!" he shouted, spewing a bloody mist through the red-stained teeth. In all the excitement, Corey had bitten his lower lip. Outside, raindrops flattened and slanted his way as if they'd been turned into Lilliputian guillotines. As the ache of the storm shook the rafters, Aunt Melissa rearranged the formal place settings on the long mahogany dining room table. Oh, how she loved her some Bram, especially the classically haunted lullabies. She wasn't sure why the music made her feel so emotional. Perhaps it was from the Mephistophelian memories it evoked, the melody or the icy ivory sound of the piano keys that created her calmness. Or maybe it was from all the white noise it kept at bay, along with the low decibel vocabulary of all the past's demons. Piano Concerto No. 2 was her favorite, with all the assemblage of Stradivarius violins fluttering their Highland wings off. It reminded her of when Corey was very young, in the basement, during the trapping season. The time frame was between mid-Octobers through February. How could she ever forget the excitement, watching Corey torture all the monarch butterflies in his smothering jar? From some invisible step halfway down the stairwell, she had spied. Somehow, the frenzy of the beautifully cloaked insects was exhilarating. His auntie was wrong, but she'd feel somehow she understood his dark art. Corey knew his Aunt Melissa had been peering. Somehow, he knew I was watching, too. Corey envisioned his aunt, an Antheria polymorphous moth, trapped in one of his crystal funeral vases, in the shimmering reflections in the semi-transparent butchered wings. Corey imagined his aunt, a wingless, wriggling at the bottom of his jar, imprisoned larva. Aunt Melissa woke precisely at 3 a.m. Her face was planted in the banana squash on the Baroque dining plate. She sat straight up without wiping her face. Momentarily, she remained seated at the formal table. Bram insisted looping in her Bluetooth speaker up high on the redwood mantel. Wi-Fi veins in her neck pulsed signal of fear and agitation. After more than a full minute, she pushed herself upright off the table. She became a frigid and stoic cassock soldier. She reached for Corey's plate and marched the poisoned hors d'oeuvres over to the trash and disposed of them. She set the smudged dish in the sink and rinsed it off. Sensing that something had changed out there, and in her, and the weakling storm, she dismissed herself to the darkening salve of her bedroom suite. From somewhere very tired inside, somehow she'd known the special holiday would never be the same. Hi, it's time I introduce myself. I'm Bobby. Of course, it was a coincidence Corey died on my birthday. I'll let you in on a little secret. I've rarely been in Corey's thoughts. When you are a ghost, you get to know these things. Corey had a lot of passengers last night. A whole family of apparitions to entertain. And of course, that oppressive, guilty conscience he had to lug about. Something had to give is the way I see it, for both of us. It's been 15-odd years since my bloody fall from the clifftop at the 19th-century Rockland Quarry. I was a senior in high school way back then. My autopsy said, death from drowning. Over the years, I've convinced myself it was an accident. But bad memories can often take on a life of their own. Eventually, you are forced to let them in. I was pushed to my death. Why all the fuss now, after all these years? Well, betrayal is a powerful emotion, first of all. That, and too much time on your hands, gets pretty damned monotonous. Eventually, my thoughts took on a life of their own. At least, the darker ones. Without exception, the vengeful memories demanded action. Otherwise, they were going to break in the doors of my skull. Corey's car was discovered upside down and empty, not far from a slippery curve at the bottom of the beautiful Mystic River, just outside of Boston. In Van Morrison's Into the Mystic River, the one soaked in the melody of revenge. I can hear Van singing now, and someone playing that soulful saxophone. Oh my. Over the years, Corey's accident has weaved itself into the rich fabric of Suffolk County folklore, a real whodunit patchwork quilt. The mystery of Corey's death, too complicated or too simple to solve, they say. If Corey knew he'd become a legend, he would have found it pleasingly sardonic, possibly an exciting reason to stick around. But Corey had little to say in the matter. I know so much about him. What I've learned since he passed is that the key to a long life is to never withhold secrets, especially from you. That's part of my mantra these days, and that you can only forgive yourself. Somehow, mythology is more closely related to the truth than spoken lies. If someone or something takes your life, you will live forever, at least in some form or capacity. If you take a life, all you get is eternal darkness. Either way, you don't have a choice, really. That's what makes this crazy thing we call life so interesting. Each summer, around campfires from just outside of Boston, through Medford and up to Winchester, along the banks of the beautiful Mystic River, young campers trade stories. Some of the youth claim Corey died of a heart attack somewhere deep in the frozen countryside. Others claimed he'd ended up in the Boston Harbor and eventually out to Mother Ocean. Elisa loves her ending the most, the one in which Corey's bowels were removed with the precision of an Edward Scissorhands on steroids. But of course, Jimmy is absolutely certain an unrecognizable body was in the trunk of the car. His throat was stuffed like sausage casings, full of worms, moss, and quarry mud. All the stories, of course, are true, and all of them will draw in the vulnerable campers, each warm summer and all the summers to follow. Now that I've been assigned back to Metamorphosis for good, you might ask, why was Corey allowed to remain on Earth after he killed his Uncle Palmer? Well, let's just say that there is a little nepotism down here in regards to our Dark Mother. Truth is, Corey was her Immaculate Conception. Y'all have to excuse me now. I'm being summoned. Dan's poetry, fiction, and nonfiction have appeared in The Apple in the Dark, Aphelion, Blazevox, Bull, Cleaver, Coffin Bell, Door Equals Jar, Drunken Pen Writing, Entropy, Dark City Magazine, Gravel, Lowstoft, Chronicles, Mystery Tribune, New Flash Fiction Review, Poetry Northwest, Spelk, Tall Tale TV, and Your Impossible Voice. Best of the Net Anthologies nomination, Coffin Bell 2020. Hey guys, hope you liked the story. If you did, I'll have links down in the description to where you can find Dan A. Cardoza. He's on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and he has a website under construction, which I'm sure I'll list at some point. If you did like the story, leave a thumbs up, and be sure to subscribe for brand new short stories 2 to 3 times a week. I'm Chris Herron, and that's it for today's Tall Tale TV.